are listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. Every week, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share thoughts on playwriting and theater. We are your hosts, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier. And today, we are so excited to have Alex Casillas on the show. Alex is a Chicana from Houston who designs lighting, scenery, and puppets. And we all met at Iowa, where I worked with Alex on my thesis show, Silo Tree, for which she did the lighting design. Alex, welcome to Beckett's Babies.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. I told Sam this before, but I've listened to the show quite a few times before, especially all of our Ryan Oliveira episodes.
Aww.
So I'm excited to be here.
That just warms my heart. Thanks for listening. Okay, so we like to start off every interview with the question, what is your earliest memory? So where was little Alex and what was she doing and thinking about?
I think my earliest memory, this is going to be pretty embarrassing, actually. My earliest memory is one of two memories, and I'll just say them both and I'll keep them brief. So I think it's either little Alex in a sundress and Easter hat post egg search, and I'm being held by my dad. And then the other one is not so endearing. I'm having a full meltdown. Four-year-old Alex, maybe 3 or 4 year old Alex, having a full temper tantrum at Celebration Station, a now defunct children's party venue in Houston, Texas, because I could neither shoot the BB gun nor ride the rides because I was a little bean, you know,
the indignity.
Yeah, so either one is centered around
justice.
Just me being a little diva in one way or another.
Well, I don't think we've ever had someone tell us about a tantrum.
Yeah, that's my, if that's we're talking earliest memory, I have to admit it's either the super cute, sunshiny, picture perfect sundress.
Or just rage.
Or just all rage and tears and I'm screaming and the attendants are actually a little afraid that I'm going to start, you know, Superman laser visioning, bright burning everybody.
I love that. What a great first memory. I love that.
Couldn't possibly tell you which one happened first.
Okay. And then how did you go from that double-sided child to into the world of theater?
Right. So this is a much more endearing story. I'm happy to tell this one. So I grew up, like I said, in Houston, and we weren't, you know, the wealthiest family around. So sort of indulgences like live theater and things like that weren't necessarily things that came along all the time. And so when I made best friends with someone who did do things like that all the time, her name is Kendall. Me and Kendall dragged me along to a live action Amelia Bedelia adaptation.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's about as magical as you could think. And they did really simple, what I now recognize as really simple theater tricks. Like the baby was played by a man's face, and then he had the little puppet arms, and then he was in like a little baby carriage, right? But for me, I was like, how did they do that? And so that's sort of my earliest theater memory. And so from then on, I knew I wanted to be involved in live performance. I just didn't know how to articulate that. I mean, I had to have been 7 years old. And then you flash forward, I'm graduating middle school, and my family goes to New York, which was a big deal. We never went, we never flew anywhere growing up, but we flew to New York City. And we saw Beauty and the Beast on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And I, at this point, was a jaded 13-year-old, angsty. It was actual magic when the Beast transformed into Prince Adam or whatever his name
is. How do they do that?
I still to this day, I don't know. And honestly, I don't want to know. It's for me, it changed my entire view of what was possible. Because I knew movies weren't real. I knew things were fake. But I couldn't explain it. There was nothing I could explain. So that was the first inclination in my head, though I wouldn't have known, I wouldn't know it until years later, that I wanted to be a designer, that I wanted to be a part of making that inexplicable, crazy, eye-widening magic happen on stage. But from where I grew up, you know, you think the only thing you can do in theater is perform, and that's not true. There's a host of other, a whole host and of other positions that you can hold and things you can do and ways you can contribute. But it, when you are looking from the outside, and I think this is something we're planning to touch on later, especially as a young Chicana from Texas with from a lower class family, it feels like the only thing you can do is be on stage, and the only way you can get there is by being really lucky. So that fully transformed my life. I went to an arts high school. I was a musical theater major for approximately half a semester before I realized that there was a design department, and I switched, and I've been designing ever since, actually.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I kind of was super lucky to figure out what it is I wanted to do with my life really early on. Because it's true. They had us design shows starting at 15 years old, 16 years old. That, not, I mean, obviously my first designs were terrible, but it did put me in an advantage later in life.
So what was your first design class, or the intro design class? What was it and what was it like?
It would have been all the way back in high school. And so probably starting second year, we took actual design classes. And it was sort of advanced design classes came later on, but the first ones we took were your gen eds. Everybody was required to take an intro to design class. And it was life drawing and elements of design, size, shape, scale, color, understanding those elements, and doing some very light studying on what those parts, those elements play in stage design. But it was very rudimentary. We made little tiny models that weren't in scale, very rudimentary and introductory level design work. But I mean, getting my hands on materials and like sort of seeing my idea take form, even in a little paste up model scale, was deeply, deeply exciting. So the first thing I ever did, I really hate that this sentence is about to come out of my mouth. The first thing that I designed, even conceptually, was Neil LaBute's Latter-day Saints play. What was it? It's a terrible play.
I don't know the title.
It's a trilogy of three plays, and it's his Latter-day Saints show. Oh, the name's gonna come to me. It's not Bang.
It's not important.
Yeah, it's really not important. And neither is Neil LaBute. He is garbage, and we can all acknowledge that. Agreed. But I was so excited that to have the, I had these, it was terrible design, you guys. You guys, this is terrible design.
Awful. Now you have to describe it.
It was a single table and chair in the middle of a stage, and then there were two giant periactoids that span for each I was about to get into that. I'll get into that. Of giant periactoids. So periactoids are giant tall towers. They don't obviously need to turn by default, but they are triangular towers. So think of a prism on its on the standing on end, and that's a periactoid. They span to have huge murals that were indicative of whatever play we were in. So for the Medea and Redux, there's like her eye.
Clever!
Yeah, and it was well. they're all giant monologues, so to be perfectly frank, you don't really need anything other than two chairs and a table. You need two chairs for just one of the plays. The other two vignettes are monologues. So that was my first design, and I can't believe I had to bring up Mila Butte. Was it a play? I feel like the devil.
Is it a play that the teacher assigned to you and then you had to figure it out?
No, I chose it. I chose it because I didn't understand. Like, I read the play when I was 14, and I was really drawn to the Medea in Redux vignette. It was to be perfectly frank, the only thing I liked about the play. Mm-hmm. But I was so drawn to it because it's this, I don't want to talk more, Bash. It's called Bash.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, Bash.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I never read a female character like that before, and I think that that's what drew me in rather than the fact that it was, whether it was a good play or not, because it's not a good play. But it's the first exposure I'd had to such adult material and a villain, an anti-hero, who I would later come to appreciate much more in the actual Medea when I read Medea mm-hmm. further on in my studies, so...
You know, we could have a whole conversation about the things we loved as teenagers that we're embarrassed by now.
Oh, yeah. That's the bonus episode. If y'all ever do a Patreon, I'm happy to come back and do Dream Hour.
Wow. Cool. And then did you continue studying design in college?
Yes, I did. I went to a very small liberal arts college in Iowa as well called Cornell College.
Oh, and yeah.
Yeah, I went there. That's why I'm so weird.
What a great place.
It's a wonderful place like no other. And some of my best memories are there. But the way that their curriculum is structured is you take one class for 3.5 weeks and then you have 3 days off, your block break, and then readjust, and then you take another class for 3.5 weeks. And it sounds easier, and then you think harder about it and you realize that your midterm is a week and a half in. Yeah, whereas you would have months to study, and then your final is after 3 weeks. So it's not for everyone. I knew a lot of people that the schedule burnt them out, but I was built for it, baby. So what that afforded me was really concentrated, pretty intense sections of my life where I could devote myself to honing this skill and doing absolutely nothing else. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, I have to take math for 3 weeks and that really sucked, but I also got to take 3D drafting for 3 weeks mm-hmm. and just hammer it into my system, because the less analog a form becomes, the harder it is for me to master. So things that have to do with the computer took me more time, but with the way the school was structured, I got to sort of just go and learn and force myself to learn because I didn't have a choice. I didn't have anything else going on academically. Wow. That is.
Yeah. And you don't have any time to procrastinate or anything.
Absolutely
else.
None.
You have to just go with it. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely none. So yeah, I continued my, I was mostly a costumer and a scenic painter and designer in high school. My lighting education formally started when I got to undergrad, and that's when I learned how to hang lights and basic electrics and lighting theory and color theory, and that's where that all of that training came in.
Cool.
Just to backtrack a little bit about, like, you know, you picking the play Mila Butte and Bash. This made me think of, like, so when you have a play, like, how maybe you're not sure about the play, but, like, how do you find ways to excite you so that you can start thinking about design? Like, if you're stuck with a play that you don't want.
Yeah, definitely. And it happens because at the end of the day, being a designer is a profession, and you're not going to be obsessed with every project, especially if you're not at the level where you can handpick your projects. And sometimes doing the, for the lack of a better term, the Neil LaBute plays, whether it determines whether or not you eat. So I've definitely been there. And, you know, your Christmas carols and Sam and Sarah, you had already graduated, but I was assigned the main stage. I was assigned my second year in grad school was Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike.
Mm.
And it's because it goes against really everything that I am as a designer. Realism is my Achilles heel, or it was, you know, at the time. And I try to look at plays that I personally may not have chosen for myself as projects, as opportunities to help someone who really cares about this show in realize their vision, because they care. Even if it's not my favorite script, even if I'd rather do another show, I've been hired onto this project and my colleague cares about what happens to Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. And so how can I assist them in doing that? And you try to find something, an element to get excited about. So with Vanya, I'm going to use Vanya as an example because it wasn't an unpleasant process. It was just a play that I don't particularly have an affinity for.
Mm-hmm.
I got excited about showing the history of the family through the items on the walls. So the historic house, I mean, it's essentially a Chekhov play, but just for a modern audience. So historic family home, tons of memorabilia. Mom and dad are present in the wall still. There's still unfinished renovations from the 1970s. House was built in the 20s. Who was building the house? Can I find a Sears and Roebuck, buy a house plan for this house? We want to toss in that mom and dad were also obsessed with theater, like Vanya. So posters of vintage posters of theaters from the era, like You're Crazy for You, Cole Porter Ventures, books, typewriters, things from eras past that Vanya either is too lazy, depending on your reading of him, or too sentimental to get rid of. What does that look like? What forms do they take? When was the last time the house was updated? Probably not since the 70s, just considering. And then digging into the dramaturgy and into the script and figuring out how I can make the most realistic stalwart set that is grounded in reality and looks very realistic, so that the insane, zany, Durang style humor can just explode out of the world and into your psyche. Because the way to, in my opinion, to make something like that work is to have everything else be so serious that you almost can't believe it when the laughs start coming.
Mm-hmm. Cool. That sounds like a really rich, like you took a project that you weren't kind of automatically excited about it and made it really rich and interesting and alive for yourself.
Yeah. It's the same thing as anything in life that you're not excited about. If you can find something to dig into, if you can find a corner of the universe that you can call your own, then it'll still look like your work at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than I phone this in because I don't like realism, or I don't like Durang, so I'm just going to research what houses look like back then. I'm going to carbon copy it. I still want it to, at the end of the day, I still want it to look like a Casillas
right
design. I want there to be hallmarks of me, and that goes with color and texture and a deep basis in dramaturgy that's respectful to the script, even if I don't care for it.
So that leads me to the question of, because you've worked on a lot of new plays, what's different for you about working on a play that's relatively new, or maybe a first production, than like a Chekhov or a Shakespeare play?
Right. So there's several ways to kind of get into this question. The biggest difference is obviously, I think, that things like Shakespeare and Chekhov have now a connotation associated with how they look, even if you're approaching them with a concept. Big epic sets or literally nothing for Shakespeare, and storied townhomes with lots of windows for maximum ennui for Chekhov. You know, there are things that we think of and now, even if we don't want to admit it, have to have when we're approaching those classics.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of new work, there are things that are really exciting. And I, don't get me wrong, I love designing Shakespeare. I love that because usually there's a concept to make it interesting. And even if there isn't, there's a lot of richness in the text that I can dig for stage pictures. Mm-hmm. New work it depends on how new it is. A new work that is just a new play that's published that's already been through its workshops and its readings. What's exciting is that nobody's done it before, and so that the connotation will come from what your team does. There's also the sort of, I don't want to say a downside because I don't think that's fair. There's a definite trend in new plays because movies and film and TV and video games and digital media are so present now that there's a lot of stage directions and imagery and asks in the script of the design team that are very cinematic in nature. Like I did Seven Spots on the Sun, and there's a moment where a pineapple is thrown into the air and then it's supposed to turn to sand upon impact of like on the hands and then turn into blood or something like that. And I never want anyone to be limited in their creativity. And if there's a message in there that you know is essential to your script and the way the story is told, I want to hear you out and I want you to have that. We also have to figure out how to put it on stage. with physical mediums and mostly, usually on a budget. So things like that, those really poetic and beautiful, but absolutely unattainable and unrealistic asks are more common in newer work, in my experience, than in those classics where, because their technology was so limited, they usually just wrote everything out that's on the stage. Your William Inges and your Lorraine Hansberry's are writing down every single little item that is in the that is in the room, and it's a realistic room and it has a place. And a lot of obviously Shakespeare doesn't pertain to this, especially with considering like Pericles and other epics of his, usually one location, because that's what at the time they thought they could achieve.
And the thing about Shakespeare is he puts it in the language, and so you don't have to see it happen on stage. I mean, you can have a storm with all your amazing technology, but you can also just have the actors say, "Oh my God, a storm!" You know, and then you understand that's what's happening. But it's so interesting because I mean, I was definitely guilty of that as a playwright just starting out, because I was told by my teachers, write impossible stage directions. And there was like, you know, definitely a trend. And I think there still is to, you know, kind of imagine the hyper theatrical or the magical. And I see my students do it, but I think this is why it's so valuable for young playwrights to have experience working in a shop or working on the design and tech side of a production, because then they can see, you know, there are ways to make magic happen on stage, and also it's not going to look like a movie. It's going to look like you know, an illusion maybe, or something that is kind of you know, maybe it's done with ribbons or maybe it's done with lighting, but it's not going to be like necessarily what's happening in your mind.
And that's what I go back. I don't want to sound harsh because I love new plays. New plays are my favorite, and I love especially being involved in the development of new plays to where I can offer guidance on, because I mean, I'm also a dramaturg. I have the firm belief that every designer should be a dramaturg, but it's my pathos and my approach to the entire thing is coming at it from serving the text first and the message first, and form should follow function and function needs structure. So how is this thing structured? I don't want to sound like I'm getting down on new writers, because I really love new work, but this I want to know what the impetus is behind I just worked on this really wonderful new play called Edit Annie, and there's this stage direction called where one of the characters, they pixelate. The direction is they pixelate.
Whoa.
So, but the writer, Mary Glenn Frederick, I believe she's New York based, had an explanation, and she was like, this character is going insane, and she thinks her old roommate is there, but she's so stuck in this digital world and she's becoming digital in her brain that Whoa. She's starting to hallucinate in that way, in the way that she would if her screen were to crash. I'm like, sounds great, let's figure out how to put it on stage. I just want everyone to serve themselves and to find truth in their own work and to write things that only serve the message and try not to give in to the desire to have spectacle, because that's usually a play killer, is when we're like, I want to write something that will look really cool, then you're designing an installation, you're not writing a play. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I think that with the new sort, it's not new, but it's definitely evolving very fast. The medium of projection design can do a lot of that, but it can't make a pineapple turn into sand, no matter how much you try. So at the end of the day, instead of leaning so heavily on projection design to solve problems like that, I'd like to impress upon people who want to write an effective play to figure out what they're trying to say when they're using these images that are very, very difficult to make real. And have a discussion with a designer, because you might even come onto something that you like even more if you discuss someone with practical experience, with someone who wants to help you turn that pineapple into sand, and you find out that the best way to do it was to have a pineapple that was half real on one side and could bleed, and then it was sand on the other side. That's what we did for our iteration. The pineapple breaks open and there's sand inside the color of blood, and it falls into the well, and then the well, because it had a mirrored bottom, you know, reflects red light.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Oh, wow.
Walls. So yeah, there's a solution to every problem. You just have to be willing to ask the question and know that you don't have to have all the answers by yourself. Theater is a team effort, and people in your team should want to help you figure out how to be your best self on the page.
Wow. This is making me think about, like, I guess when you're collaborating and you're working with the playwright and the director and everyone, like, you know, for a playwright, like, what's the most helpful to you? What can that a playwright could offer to you as a designer? You know, like, what the hell was that? Oh my God, Jesus. Okay. I'm fine. What the hell? What was my question? Did you get it?
So maybe give it one more go because the ghost spooked you.
Oh yeah, my question was, like, I guess when you're working with a playwright, like, what is most, oh my God, City of LA is after me.
What's happening?
Jesus, I hate this place. So no, the question is, when you're working with a playwright, right? I guess it's like, what can playwrights do to be more helpful and useful, like, for the designer when it comes to their work and helping you be more, you know, with the design to help realize those designs?
Yeah, for sure. I think every designer is different. If I'm speaking for myself and a lot of people who work like me, similar to me, my goal in every venture, as it should be, is to provide the team, the playwright, the director, everyone, the producer, with the tools that they need to bring the script as on the page to life in its truest sense, not to impress different meaning onto a script or to have an installation design that is masquerading as a scenic design or a lighting design. I want to help you deliver the message that you want to deliver to an audience a captive audience. So why did you, being able to answer questions like, why did you write the play? What is this play about? What do you want people to walk away feeling? What do you want them to know that they didn't know after they, before they left this theater, before they saw your show? What do you want them to feel? How do you want them to feel? Do you want them to be afraid? Do you want them to laugh? Do you want them to think? Do you want them to feel alienated? Do you want an escape? I want to know what form you, I want to know what function your play has so that I can give you the proper form. Mm-hmm. So if you can answer questions for me, specifically me, I don't want to speak for everyone, because everybody is different. Every designer is different. Some are much more technical. Some are much more organic. I kind of fall a little bit in the middle, and I want to bring it back to the text every single time because I'm not a studio artist. I'm a designer. Mm. It matters to me. It is important to me that at the end of the day, it's your play on stage and not a you know, something masturbatory for me and for my ego. And like, I can't do that unless you can answer pretty difficult questions. Our colleague, our dear friend and colleague and former classmate, Teresa Giacopassi, wrote this really marvelous play that I still think about every day, pretty much. It's called Squeeze. And she obviously eventually sat me down and we talked about it. And me and Ariel, our other friend Ariel Francoeur, talked about it. And
great director.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic director. Fantastic human. Fantastic new mom, too. Yes. New moms all around. She had a hard time talking on why she wrote the play, but it's because it was too personal at the time. It was too close, and she was too close to it, and it was too under her skin, mm-hmm. and she wasn't ready. But then, give her some slack. Like, the play wasn't done. We're staging it before the play was workshopped and finished. So of course she's not ready to answer those questions. In any other case, I'd be working on a play that's been finished for years, if not. Mm-hmm. more. Mm-hmm. So I obviously I only bring that up to say that by sort of asking her pointed questions like, what do you want people to feel, what do you want, who is this play for, and her sort of coming around and answering those questions valiantly and bravely, because it was very, I mean, there's a reason I still think about that play, is haunting. Mm-hmm. And deep, and it had teeth, and it, especially when as a female identifying person watching that play, is hurts, and you don't know why at first, mm-hmm. until you have a little bit of introspection. That's just what that play was. But I guess that's a long-winded way of saying being able to answer questions about your play without flinching and without getting defensive, because at the end of the day, we want to do is help you, is mm-hmm. help your thing come to life.
Yeah.
Lovely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So much to think about. No, I'm just thinking.
Yeah. I didn't mean to bring the mood down.
No, you didn't. No, it's great.
I also didn't mean to imply that your plays are Frankensteins and that I am going to bring them to life.
So you designed both scenic and lighting designs, and I'm curious about what, if any, what are kind of the different ways you approach, like, how you're going to tell the story of the play through different media? And also, do you ever do both for a single production, and what's that like?
Yeah. I think that it was harder for me to learn lighting design because, as I said before, the less analog, the less hands-on I can be with a medium, the harder time I have mastering it. But I think the biggest difference between scenic and lighting design is not a difference that you would expect. There are a ton of differences between the mediums, don't get me wrong, but the first one that comes to mind is that scenic design, though front-loaded and very stressful at the beginning of the process, just trying to account for all the details and make sure everything has OSHA regulations in check and ADA access and fire access, and that everything has a railing and that every possible thing is accounted for. If I have if it's a bustle show, it's a period show with bustles, I need to make sure that those doors are probably custom and wider.
Oh wow!
Depending on how big we're going, if it's realistic, there a regular door will be fine. But if we're talking like Marie Antoinette, big, huge panions, it's not going to happen. So we need to think about that while we're designing the show. And little details like that are what were really hard for me to get into in terms of realism. Mm-hmm. Something like Silo Tree or Trick, mm-hmm. for you two respectively, there's a lot more leeway because I don't have to worry about stair banisters or doorways or even doors most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
There's just things that are essentially sort of off my stress out about this list. And there are other things, of course, now added, but so details like that right at the beginning, and having all the drafting ready and making sure all the drafting is perfect and that everything's kosher and that I'm not missing anything, and the paint elevations are enough for the charge to do their job, and all of the props are in order, and the props list is to the props person. If there's not a props person, I'm the props person. So all the prop designs and all of that stuff is just immaculate. Yeah, immaculate. It has to be right, because the slightest difference can mean, especially if we're talking about levels or moving or automation or pneumatics, it could mean someone's safety. So I have to get it right. But I get to do that in the privacy of my own home,
mm-hmm.
or workspace. And I get to stress out about that alone.
Right, right.
With lighting design, you have a whole different stress on you. So usually you have a master electrician who takes care of your electrical loads and your lighting, your weight load. So that's not something that I usually have to concern myself with. I have been my own master electrician before, and it's not fun, but usually I don't have to worry about that. The real stress comes during tech.
Right, right.
Because as a scenic designer, I get to sort of perfect. I get to work it and make sure when I present it, it's flawless and it's, how did she do it? There's no hiding when you're lighting in the room. You're doing it live. Everybody's watching you. Everybody's waiting.
Everyone's
on
getting
you.
Impatient.
Everybody's looking at your way and wondering why you're taking so long. And I'm like, this is a very complicated sequence. We want to just do this and get it right now so that we don't have to come back to it and have it be a mess later. And 9 times out of 10, I'm right. But it is really nerve-wracking having people watch you while you work and knowing in your heart that it will never be finished. You'll just have to stop working.
Wow.
There's a deep bittersweetness for me to being a lighting designer, because I know that what's on stage, as wonderful as it may be, fantastic, everybody's like, oh, that was perfect. And I know that if I had 30 more minutes or 2 more days, it would look exactly like it does in my head.
That is so stressful.
I almost guarantee every lighting designer feels the same way, because eventually you just have to stop, and there's no more time, and you have to stop. Even the biggest Broadway houses, somebody has to stop programming at some point and put something out there that they are chewing their nails about, because it's like watching your kid go to kindergarten and you can't hold their hand anymore. It's very nerve-wracking. That is to say, doing both is terrible. It's awful. Some people love it, and I understand why, because I already mentioned working on Seven Spots on the Sun. I did design lighting and scenery for that show, and I designed puppets as well, so I had full creative control over the world of the play. It's like being handed a lump of clay and an idea, and then the only one in charge of you is you. So if you're not accountable, mm-hmm. and you give in to to the desire to put on a spectacle now that you have all of this creative power. You are, I have the power. I had the power, but I wanted to remain true to the script. I wanted to put on the play as written. And luckily, I didn't have all that power while I was still in school. Otherwise, I would have succumbed to the technique. But by then, I was already an early career designer. I'd already gotten that out of my system, hopefully, she says, looking around. So having that much creative control is very seductive. Mm-hmm. You are stressed out from moment zero to moment you're done. Calm down. Stop hyperventilating.
Right. And there's no other designer who can, like, you can be like, oh, they'll solve that problem.
There was no. Yeah. Well, I had my wonderful assistant, Merrick Bauer. But Merrick can't solve any problem. No, Merrick can't do that for me. I have to figure that out because it's my design. And mm-hmm. luckily I wasn't doing scenography. So I wasn't doing costumes as well. And there was a sound designer, but, yeah, there's no one to fall back on. If something goes wrong, it would have been my fault. If something didn't work, it would have been on me. And there would have been no one else to turn to or to blame. So having that much control and power comes at a cost. Mm-hmm. And it's your personal sanity. Some people love scenography. They love being in charge of the entire thing. They must have a lot of time on their hands because I just, that show almost killed me.
Wow. Yeah.
But it was a labor of love. I mean, I still have, I don't have, unfortunately, pictures of it on my website yet, but I'm trying to, now that this is coming out, you're going to be blasting my website everywhere. I'm just going to try to get those on.
So, one thing I'm curious to ask you is, there's been a lot of conversation in the theater world about representation of different identities on stage and in the stories we tell, and I think less of a conversation about representation on production teams, and I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on that?
So this is an issue I specifically brought up, and I have a lot of feelings about this. Mm-hmm. I think that the representation on stage, the way that we're seeing more work by Black actors and trans actors and really interesting creative projects that wouldn't be possible without these incredible talented performers from communities that aren't typically represented on stage. And I couldn't be happier for them, and I'm really excited for them. And I'm wondering why this is going to be largely sort of a commentary on Lort theaters and Broadway houses and those big houses that could afford to hire they don't need to hire Natasha Katz 50 times in a year. They can also hire someone else. There is someone with just as much skill, I can guarantee. Who would serve better on these shows like your Shucked, your Hamiltons, your In the Heights's. I just get a little frustrated when I see these wonderful plays that are being put on by wonderful playwrights and have these rich, diverse casts, but we're still hiring white male designers, cis white male designers. And I know that these are the guys that have been doing it forever and they always turn in a great project. And I would never argue with that. I'm just saying I would challenge these producers who keep hiring the same faces and the same looking faces that have they ever conceived. And I'm not saying everybody is doing this. I don't want to start any fights online. It's just an overall trend in the theater community that while on stage, we're looking at really cool progress, but behind the desk on the other side in the tech room, where are all of the trans designers? Where are the queer Black designers? Where are the queer Latinx designers, Latine designers? Where are we? Mm-hmm. Because no one wants to take a chance on someone who doesn't have 5,000 credits under their belt, but we're not getting those credits because we don't have those credits. So on one hand, it's frustration. And on the other hand, it's an honest question. Don't we think that stories that are being told about, I don't like using the term marginalized communities, but I will use it for sake of clarity. Don't we think that water by the spoonful would be served by an all Latine production team?
Right. Yeah.
Where there's and I don't want to be this person who's saying that everyone's experience is, I can't speak for all Chicanas. I can't speak for all queer people. I can't speak for all women. I can't speak for any blanket community, but I just know that there's going to be more shorthand. There's going to be less questions if I am designing a Tania Saracho or a Marisela Trevino Orta piece. There are just things that I'm not going to have explained to me because that's my experience, and that's time and that's money. Mm-hmm. So even from a pragmatic standpoint, it only makes sense because no one's going to have to explain to me the impact that Selena Quintanilla left on the Tejano community. I already know that because that's my experience, but you would have to explain it to Ken Billington. So I just...
Yeah, or a Korean team for Sarah's play, States.
You should have a Korean team because there are things, or a Korean American team, because there are things that you will not have to explain to them, even if they're very small and don't seem important.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Someone who shares a similar perspective to you, someone who shares a similar background, who just sort of knows the way the world looks at them, understands the way you want your world to look.
Yeah. This is, I didn't think about this until you're talking about it, because I really, like, when it comes to design, it's like, it truly is like the last thing I, because, well, it's one, it's just because I never go into production. So it's like, I just don't think about working with a designer at that point, you know? But as you're talking about this, and like one of my plays, Stains, and there's a new scene that I wrote where the Korean grandmother, she's like making kimchi, like, but like old school, like, you know, like, on her, you know, she's crouching down and like in a those big giant tub, plastic tubs, and she's like making kimchi like that. Like, even that, I was just like, I was just, as you were talking about, I'm like, if some white dude was like, how am I supposed to light the smell here? You know, it's like, right. I was like, I don't get the, you know, I could just like, I don't know. I'm like, then I'm having to explain, well, like, this is the way grandmothers do this. Like, this is just like Korean grandmas. If you grew up with one, like, they just do this. So I don't know. It's like explaining. I could see that I'm having this imaginary conversation trying to explain like why I wrote it this way, you know?
Right. Yeah. And then it could become a conversation about like, oh, will our audience get it? Should we change a line? You know, and whereas if you're not having to explain to your designers what a moment means, then you can feel like they've got your back in the production.
Yeah. I have a lot of feelings on this. So I just feel like everyone deserves a team who's best suited for the show, not because they are the guy that everyone's hiring and he gets all the jobs because he's been doing it forever. I think plays deserve to be told by people who care to tell them. Mm-hmm. And that requires production artists and builders and sound artists and makeup artists and designers and painters who care about the subject matter of the play. And probably, and I'm going to be honest, like when I did Braided Sorrow, which is a Marisela Trevino Orta, another former classmate and colleague of ours.
And former Beckett's Babies guest.
when I did her show Braided Sorrow, it is about the violent, short, in a nutshell, a story about the violence and rampant femicide of young female factory workers in Juarez. It's something I take very personally because I have family in Mexico, and because it could have been me. I look exactly like half of the girls on those posters. And in another life, it could have been me. And I take it very personally. And it means I show up more for the show. But if I was a white man who's perfect, who never has to look both ways after he leaves his house because he's a white man and doesn't worry about those things, then I wouldn't take it personally. And I'd probably turn in something really beautiful without a soul.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wouldn't understand that pain. And I had to take a break after that show, though, too, because it really everything I had to design about that show was about designing pain towards people who look like me. So maybe I took it a little too personally. But for me, it's hard to separate that line.
Wow, yeah.
Juicy
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, go ahead, Sarah.
No, it's just juicy stuff.
Juicy. So juicy.
Juicy like plastic tub kimchi. My mom, my abuela did a lot of things in plastic tubs too, unrelated. She like made her masa in a plastic tub. I don't know if that's esoteric.
Plastic tub aesthetics. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, you've kind of mentioned some plays and that you've enjoyed working on and playwrights you've enjoyed working with. But I'm just wondering if you can highlight a couple of maybe recent projects or things you've read that you would love to work on that really speak to you.
Oh, yeah. So I can't recall if I've mentioned... No, I mentioned Maricela. I didn't mention Tania Saracho. I'm reading this play... I haven't finished it yet, but I can already tell I love it and I would love to design it, called Mala Yerba. It is a newer Tania Saracho play. And when I tell you within the first two pages of reading it, I heard all of my tias. The way that she says something's purdy is the way that it's very specific to Texas, like South Texan Chicana, the way that we speak. Oh, that's so purdy. I could hear my cousins and aunts in the opening pages, and that's how I know. I'm like, oh, I'm into this. I'm in it. And it's also queer, and it also has a bunch of really great telenovela style elements to it that I can't get enough of, that are deeply my aesthetic. So, and it's also tightly written. It's kind of like if a telenovela was good, if it was like objectively good, rather than just good because it's trash and I love trash. Really interesting characters, really sexy components. So it has everything that checks my boxes, ladies and gentlemen. You guys can come too. That's a play that I would like to do. I don't know if I'm the correct designer for it, but I'd be happy to scenic design this show. If anyone has read Orange Julius by Basil, I hope I'm saying Krivendahl. What a fantastic roller coaster. I don't know the last time that I've read something that is not, I don't want to call it a memory play because it's not a memory play. It's a present play where there are a lot of fast memories happening. I don't know that I have a name for the style of this play. Really, really brutal, but beautiful, like sort of this whiplash between unending profanities and soft, simple moments and these like little gossamer images. Really well paced. I can't say enough good things about this play. I would love to work on that if the right production team was assembled. And then
yeah, it's a beautiful play.
I just did the it's so good. I just did the conceptual design for Maricela's play, Maricela Trevino Orta's play, for just tuning in. December, which is this two-hander, which I usually have a hard time getting through two-handers because they and I'm with all due I they remind me of Waiting for Godot. all due respect to the namesake of the podcast, but like, or they're trying to be Waiting for Godot, but this is like a, this is a very different, it's a romance, this sort of May December romance happening between a professor and her former students. I have to stress former students. That was produced and for the Alley Theater's All New Festival, and I did a like a pretty fleshed out design for them. There was a ground plan and a color rendering and a napkin sketch and like sort of all the first stages.
Cool.
That was not realism. Like I said, realism is not usually my wheelhouse, but if it's Maricela, I'm going to say yes.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of, if anyone knows me, I've been sort of pigeonholed in later years as the abstract, crazy designer. So every now and then something that's just in one room in a house, I'll take it. This really, the goal was to bring the house sort of to life as the other character. I think that this is a perspective that Maricela and I share. I think that people think that women get old after they turn 40. And that's...
You're so right.
The stupidest shit I've ever heard. And that women become like spinsters and they start wearing cardigans and they like their hair is gray and they look like that cartoon granny from Looney Tunes and just turn unsexy and stop wanting romantic and sexual connection. And that's so decidedly untrue. I can attest to it personally. But the character of Carolina in her show is this vivacious, funny, experienced, well-traveled, sexy character with a lot of writing skill and just verve and vibe and life. And I wanted to bring a perspective to it that's like, this woman is like Sandra Cisneros level designing her house. She's got this house. She's a professor at the university. She's had this house since she got here, this little townhome. She's colored the walls. Her posters are everywhere. She has a record player is the central object with all of her cassettes and her records. And there's a must-read bookshelf by her couch, and there's plants, and there's... I wanted to approach this like the house has to be a third character that is creating a sense of magnetism and a sense of her everywhere to the point that it is intoxicating this man. And he keeps getting drawn back to her and drawn back to her over the course of, I believe it's 2 decades in the show.
And that's what I love about that is like your conceptual design is like helping show that she's like energetic and dynamic and exciting and not like boring, which is boring, so important. It's such an important part of telling the story. Yeah,
she still listens to Joy Division, guys. She's hot.
Yeah,
and her house is hot.
That's awesome. Well, I hope someone will produce that with you as a designer.
Oh, that'd be
let's
so
just
great.
Manifest that right here.
Let's manifest that. Let's right manifest
here.
It. Yeah.
You heard it first, here, folks. Yeah. Yep. You got it. That's our mantra here.
Yeah. Yeah, you can actually see that you can see that design on her Instagram at Maricela T. Orta on Instagram. And it'll be on my Instagram soon, I promise. I'm so bad at updating that thing.
Cool. Yeah, so go look at it, listeners.
Yeah. Go check it out. Tell me how hot you think the house is. 10 out of 10.
All right. So I got one last question before we move on to Glistens. So I guess, you know, everything you've learned, you've grown a little. You experienced things. What advice would you give to people who might be interested in design? I know we have a lot of probably like listeners who are into playwriting, but you know, maybe they're like, F this, I'm gonna go into design.
Oh, no.
You know, what advice would you give to those designers, for those up and coming or interested designers?
Yeah, I guess I think that even if your audience's majority playwrights, dramaturgs, devisers, sort of even directors. I think that anyone can learn a lot by taking in some information about an entire area, an entire component of the thing you're trying to do. As designers, we have to learn a lot about plays and play structure and analysis and playwriting. It seems counterintuitive that the opposite wouldn't be true, especially if you're trying to write something really spectacular that you'd like to see on stage. Having some considerations for taking control of the visual presentation of your work that you've worked really hard on could only be served by listening to some lectures by designers, reading some books about design. There's a really wonderful bookstore in Chicago that just opened up. I think it's called Understudy.
I think that's right.
They have a whole section on design, and I'm happy. I don't have any off the dome titles for you now, just because it's been quite a long time since I've cracked a design book, just because I've started living the life. I actually need to read some more design books. But I'm happy to provide something maybe for when this comes out in the list of recommends at the bottom. I would encourage people who are early in their design career to take a drawing class, or even take a sketchbook to the park and just draw. Those skills that you can hone in your downtime will save you a lot of time when you get into an actual project. I would encourage early career designers to take jobs that they wouldn't usually take, to or volunteer to be an electrics, help out on electrics and learn about electrics, learn about scenic painting, learn about puppetry, go to a lot of shows, especially if you can get a student discount, go to shows and watch shows and try to articulate to yourself what you like about what you're seeing on stage or what you don't like about what you're seeing on stage. Every single experience that you have and that you take the time to reflect on will form your opinion as an artist and sharpen your pencil on the page. So I just encourage early career designers to try things that maybe they're out of, because the same goes for you can't just be a scenic designer. You can't just take scenic courses. You can't just try to scenic paint. You should learn about costumes, because all of the elements only work when they interact properly, and we can only create a good scenographic experience when we know how to boost our teammates' work. Learn more about color theory. Get a book on color theory and figure it out. Popping characters out from the background is a skill that needs to be mastered. Learn what is the costume designer's palette? Is it light? Is it dark? Help them show off their work by using a contrasting color, and help actors of color by putting them in colors that suit their structure and their skin color, and that will help them stand out from the background. If you're doing an all black production of whatever, who cares, of Romeo and Juliet, don't put them against a dark background. Put them against a background that's going to help them show up. Just thinking about these things and considering to the finest detail how you can serve a cast and a script and a director and other designers, even in theory, when you get to the table and when you finally make it into the room, it will put you heads and shoulders above everybody else, because nobody else is thinking about it. And that's why the way that our production teams look right now, that's why people are still thinking that, oh, it's blue and orange for people of color, right? No, it's not. No. Okay, Michael Bay, stop.
This is so great. I feel like we just got a masterclass of advice.
Yeah, I just think, I don't want to sound like I'm phoning it in, but reading books about design can only help you in drawing. And I don't want to rehash what I just spent however long talking about, but step out of your comfort zone and be a little anthropologist, because all of those little things you tuck away will come up sooner or later. I promise.
That's awesome. Yeah. I want to like look for design books now.
Yeah, I know. I know Jennifer Tipton has a really wonderful book on lighting. She's a female lighting pioneer. Mm-hmm. You can eschew Stanley McCandless. You don't need to read that. But I know there's a few books. I can't reach back in my vault and find them at the moment. I'm so sorry.
No worries.
That's okay. Yeah. We can let the listeners do some work.
Yeah.
I could just ask ChatGPT and they'll just tell it to me.
Oh, yeah, ChatGPT. How do I become a lighting designer? ChatGPT.
I do know on Netflix there is a design-centric show where they interview a famed stage and concert designer, Ez Devlin. I would highly recommend checking that out, because what listening to the way her mind works was really eye-opening for me, because we actually work very similarly. And I was like, oh my god, me and Ez Devlin. Okay.
Yeah, I'll definitely check that out. All right, that was awesome. We're gonna move on to Glistens. This is our favorite part of the show, where we talk about, you know, what jumped out at us this week, or it could be anything. It could be something you discovered, something new, something you did, whatever. So I'll start first. So we are recording on Saturday, July 29th. And it's been a couple of weeks now, but I participated in a week-long monologue joke writing challenge through this collective, Collective. it was really fun. It was just like, I've never written any like late night style things, right? Like, and I was like, oh, I'm so curious what that's like. And I want to just be forced to do something, like to force me to get out of my comfort zone and just try it out. And so what they did was, in this week long challenge, was like, they sent me the style of the host. Like, I think one day was like Z-Way. And they gave you headlines, and then you had to write 10 jokes based on those three headlines.
Whoa.
And it was really nice. We got an email, and then it was like, from their network, it was like, you know, a current late night writer or whoever is like, they give you like little tip, like a inspiring quote or tip, you know, to get you going. So it was like really nice.
That's cool.
I was like, oh my gosh, Z-Way. Like I've only watched like clips from her show went viral or something, and I'll watch it and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. But it was it definitely just forced me to write, and I really liked it. And I really like it. And I feel like I've also just started writing jokes for this podcast, The Dump. And so it was like helping me get into that mindset of like headline joke writing and that kind of thing. So it's really fun. I don't like the news. That's the thing. Yeah. News.
Not a lot.
I hate the news.
Not a lot. But
it's forcing me to
like.
There's a lot
of jokes you can make about recent news.
Yeah. But I don't care. I just don't care.
All your jokes are about Barbie.
I was like, oh, here we go. Barbie jokes. Here we go. No. But yeah, that's what I did. So, Sam, what's your glisten?
Well, I saw this incredible documentary as part of there's an environmental film festival here in Boulder. And as the closing event, they played this documentary called Patrick and the Whale, which is like, I mean, it's just so beautiful, you guys. It's this guy over, I think, maybe over a year, more than a year, swimming and getting to know these sperm whales. And wow, I'm just really into this kind of thing lately, like interspecies communication, connection. So he kind of, his name is Patrick Dykstra, and he builds these relationships with these whales. He kind of gets to know them. He can recognize them. I mean, they all look the same to me, but he gets to know their personalities. And there's this incredible moment where this one, so sperm whales when they have a calf, the mothers that will dive really, really deep to go feed the giant squid, and then they come back up to be with their calf, and the calves just nurse and they can't dive that deep. So they will leave the calf with a babysitter, another whale, while they dive for like 45 minutes. And so there's this moment in the documentary where this whale that he's gotten to know over, I think, like multiple years, and he hasn't seen her in a while, and he kind of wonders why. And then one day she shows up with her calf and looks at him and then dives and leaves her calf with him. And he's like, oh, okay, I guess I'm the babysitter. but so it's just, yeah, it's just things like that. Whales are amazing.
The trust.
And one of the things I learned is that these young males are kind of kicked out of the pod because they live in these matriarchal pods. And so the young adolescent males, when they reach a certain age, are kicked out by the moms. And they have to just go off on their own, and they find each other, and they form these communities of adolescent males that become like their new family, and they live with them for a few years before they then kind of go off on their own. But they become so tightly bonded that a lot of times the reason that they will beach themselves is one of them will get disoriented or start to beach and be unable to turn around, and the others will just go with him because they love each other so much. And so even if they could like turn around and save themselves, they won't, because they have such incredible bonds.
Wow.
Yeah. Patrick wow. and the Whale. I recommend it. It's a documentary.
Where is it? Where's that?
You know, I don't know if it's streaming yet, actually. I think it's currently making like the film festival circuit, I'm guessing it will be available to stream soon at some point.
Stay tuned. I saw it on we have our little notes document. It's like Patrick and the Whale, and I was thinking The Whale, the movie, and then
not to be confused with the Sam Hunter play/film. Yeah. Yes. Good point.
Okay.
What about you, Alex? What's your glisten?
Okay. So first of all, I just want to say, if a beautiful whale left her calf with me, I would feel honored and I would die a happy woman. Just gotta be clear on that.
Just wait till she comes back first before you die.
Well, yeah, I'd probably die upon her return, and then she would carry me down to this giant squid. Yeah, no, she wouldn't do that, probably. My glisten is, so I don't, anyone who knows me really well personally knows that I'm a huge nerd for like Dungeons and Dragons. I love Dungeons and Dragons. I love Critical Role. I love Dimension 20. And I always have, but they just, their new campaign that they just finished and I'm catching up on is called Dungeons and Drag Queens. And ooh, they have really, really popular drag queens. They've got Bob the Drag Queen, Alaska Thunderfuck, Monet Exchange, and they are all they're all really playing. Oh, and Jujubee, all playing real Dungeons and Dragons. They're rolling their perception rolls. They are, tell me when I lose you. They have to use skill in battle and improv and are like really role play and get into these characters. Tears have been shed, you guys. Tears have been shed. Their makeup does not budge. Truly. So it's this weird Venn diagram of my interests, and it has the added bonus of being this really like, it's a comedy show on Dropout TV, which is a comedy streaming service. But it's this quietly sort of defiant political statement, since we all know that there's a lot of terrible slander being said about the drag community and all of these bands. Yeah. And so the fact that the response from Dropout TV and like Sam Reich, who's the producer, was like, Yeah, no, we're going to have a whole season with drag queens.
Oh my gosh. I want to watch this.
Yeah, you got to watch it. It's I have this weird, terribly embarrassing parasocial relationship with Brennan Lee Mulligan, who runs these campaigns. I'm just deeply obsessed with him. And the fact that he got Alaska Thunderfuck, who's one of my favorite drag queens on it, I am speechless. But yeah, laughs, tears, pure awe. It has it all.
Cool.
Amazing.
All right. That was fun.
Yeah, thanks so much, Alex. Thanks for coming on. And this was amazing. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and letting us pick at your brain.
Yeah.
Yes. Anytime. There's a lot of it.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.